Welcome to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, discussing and analyzing the legal implications of national security issues across the globe. Our hosts, Hogan Lovells attorneys Michael Scheimer and Tim Bergreen, have decades of hands-on experience in national security issues and how they relate to their clients' day-to-day goals. And now, here are Michael and Tim.
Hey, Tim. Happy Friday. Nice to see you again.
Good to see you, Mike. Happy Friday. And quite a week it's been.
Yeah, so we are recording this during the week that they're in the news. There's been reports of a U.S. Air National Guard, young man age 21, has been identified as the source of classified information leaks that have been making their rounds on the internet. And so our topic today, before that had even happened, was originally generally planned to be an episode on classified information and security clearances. But we're going to briefly also touch on these latest leaks. We've been planning an episode to talk about the basics about U.S. government classified information rules, personnel clearances for industry and government, and also actually sharing national classified types of information with allies, like the Five Eyes allies, NATO, and the rest, because that does happen. But now we're adding a little bit on top of what was going to sort of be our Classified Information 101 episode because of the latest developments in the news.
Yeah. And, you know, really quite stunning. Jack Teixeira, I guess, is the kid's name. 21 years old, Airman First Class in the Massachusetts Air National Guard. He's with an intelligence wing stationed out of Cape Cod. I guess he was either on active duty or TDY'd in some way down to Fort Bragg. And I'm not sure whether that was the first time that he encountered what looked to be quite a treasure trove of information that he probably should not have had access to in any meaningful sense, and then used it to sort of share with his buddies. I think it's, you know, as you mentioned, Mike, I think it's a really good real life jumping off point to talk a little bit about what classified information is, who has access to classified information, how it's stored, to sort of try to lift the veil a little bit on a subject that for most people probably is still a mystery. You know, why don't we sort of start generically? You know, what is classified information?
Yeah, so we'll start with the basics. And Tim, to your point on both this story and I think other news stories, probably in the last 6 months to a year, sometimes there's a lot of myths floating around about classified information. And we certainly, you know, deal with this in our day-to-day work as well. So we're going to probably hit on some sort of dispel some myths here about what classified information is and how the whole process works. So I think most of our listeners can understand at least the concept, whether from popular media or from the news, that classified information is government secrets. It's sensitive information that really shouldn't go out there. There are three basic classification levels in the United States. And we'll talk about how allies use similar ones as well. But the ones people hear the most probably are, oh, top secret. And then one tier down is secret. We actually do have a category that's confidential. And Tim, I can't tell you how many times folks kind of miss that. It still exists. It's not necessarily used all that much, but it is a classification level. And keep in mind, you know, we are attorneys at a law firm. The word is just confidential. So I can't tell you in detail how many times this might have come up in a certain scenario, but sometimes folks get confused. So this is sort of a myth thing, again, I want to dispel is, you know, confidential in the context of U.S. government information, whether you're a contractor in industry, right, or you're the government, could actually mean classified information. It's not just prevented from being released under Freedom of Information Act. I've definitely dealt with issues where there are folks talk bandied around the word confidential, and on examination, it turned out it's actually a classified document or issue or whatever.
So just to interject really quickly, when I was at the State Department, a lot of sort of the cable traffic, the routine cable traffic was confidential. And confidential is classified. You know, there are confidential cover sheets that you put on confidential documents. The damage to the national security is not as great as a secret or top secret document, but, you know, it's still something that somebody somewhere has judged that he or she doesn't want getting out into the wild.
Yep. And to that point, it's still, as an individual, or again, I work a lot in the government contracting industry, right? As a company, you still need security clearances to access confidential classified information. So we've had situations where a company, particularly like a lot of the companies in the emerging tech space who are not established government contractors, they may be looking at a solicitation, or want to put a bid on some new government program, and they see buried within some requirement about confidential information or having a security clearance. And they may not realize, because, in the media, everyone just says secret or top secret. They may not realize right away that you have to get, and for industry, we call it a facility security clearance as a company, in order to bid on the contract, right? And that's another angle I want to get into on this too, is that for industry, safeguarding of classified information, as opposed to government, your company, your employer, as a contractor or a grantee or whatever the case might be, needs a facility clearance. So the U.S. government vets the company, right? And you've got to have a facility security officer, an FSO, and there's other requirements. We don't have to get into all that now, but that's something I think that is missed maybe both in industry, even in media, because we're so focused on the people. Well, if I'm a government employee, and Tim, you can jump in on more of this too, particularly with, the airman who was in the news, you still have to go through the personnel security clearance process. We call them, PCLs. The process to get a PCL as a person is generally the same for industry that is for in the government. You fill out the same background forms. It's the SF-86, standard form 86. Everyone who has to get a PCL has to go through that. But I do note that I think sometimes we get, companies who we work with or talk to who maybe folks have come from government or they have or prior military experience, for example, and they've had a PCL in the past or at the government. And they don't always realize if you're going to start a new company, tech startups, again, another example I'm giving, you need a facility clearance for the whole entity, the company. That concept doesn't exist in government. It's just about the people, right? So I put that out there. It's a real basic thing, but it does come up a lot that it's like, wait, I left government or, maybe someone's even still a military reservist and they've kept their clearance active through the military. The person has been cleared and authorized at a certain level, but the company doesn't have a clearance, right?
Right.
So the company can't bid on a contract that's classified until they get that clearance.
So let's talk a little bit, you talk about how companies get a clearance, but how does an individual person get a security clearance and what's that process like?
Yeah, so we mentioned the SF-86, that's the form you have to fill out. The background investigation will go, a little further depending if you need secret or top secret access. But
assume TS here.
So there's a lot of questions on the form that are going to go back a number of years, and you submit this online, and the background investigation is, we should actually note this too, because this was in the news a few years ago too. It used to be done through OPM, Office of Personnel Management, which is part of the executive branch of the White House. There was a big OPM breach in, 2016, 2017, right? There's a big cybersecurity issue. So now the Background Investigations Bureau is what was stood up. It's been moved back over to the Department of Defense, which is interesting because we can talk about sort of the different agencies in the classified information world, right? But it's not just the Department of Defense that produces or generates through itself or its contractors classified information. Many government agencies do that. But DOD's, kind of a behemoth in the sort of, with budget authority, right? They actually now have the Background Investigations Bureau role within DOD, and it's part of the DOD Security Clearance Regulator, formerly known as the Defense Security Service, or DSS. For the last couple of years, they've now been called the Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency, or DCSA. We love our acronyms in the aerospace and defense field. Not to be confused with DSCA, the Defense Security and Cooperation Agency, which is a different part of DOD. Another myth there, right? I can't tell how many times I've seen the acronyms flipped. That Background Investigations Bureau handles the background investigations. They do processing for the vast majority of folks. I think I will note that some of the other big players in this space are like the Department of Energy. And we've already said, here's three classification levels, confidential, secret, top secret. And as you said, the difference is the damage to national security. The Department of Energy, for certain types of information under the Atomic Energy Act, there are other classifications. So it was restricted data and formerly restricted data. This deals with nuclear weapons. And some of that actually predates, because on the Atomic Energy Act, what I'm talking about in confidential, secret, and top secret for the rest of you know, the classified world. But I also mentioned that too, because, you know, sometimes there's questions sort of in industry about what we're supposed to have access to, what we're going to generate. The DOE has their own process for people having access to restricted information, or formally restricted, the stuff in the Atomic Energy Act. But the confidential, secret, top secret stuff is governed by an executive. The most recent executive order is 13526, classified national security information. I think it was 2009, 2010. And the reason I'm saying that is because sometimes it's surprising to folks that the classification levels and sort of how you vet people is largely created through the executive branch. There's very few statutes that talk about what's classified information and how do you vet people and what happens next. Now, there are statutes like the Espionage Act on how you may prosecute people who have mishandled classified information, but sort of the whole framework, the classified information program in the U.S. is sort of executive branch created, which sometimes folks are surprised about. Except I will note again, for the Department of Energy, the Atomic Energy Act actually has defined sort of their classified world. So I went a little bit off the personnel thing there. Sorry.
No, that's fine. So let me like pick the thread up a little bit and bring you to the next part of the chain. So this new NBIS or whatever out at the Defense Department or FBI for some other agencies, you know, gets your SF-86. They go through it. They contact people on the form. They ask those people to give them other names. They run down employment checks, do a whole bunch of other things. And this is a process that usually takes 6 to 12, sometimes more months, depending on the person's foreign contacts, etc. So someone gets a clearance, they get read into various compartments, and they sign all, you know, their life away on the dotted line. So then they get access to classified information. What does that mean?
Yeah, before we get to access, you made a good point there about, you know, the compartments and things like that. The final step, once you've gone through this process, and I'll note also, you know, there is an administrative appeals process that's at Doha Defense Office if you're in appeals, if you're doing DOD, but I mentioned that because there's a lot of questions on the form. There may be things that come up that the government have concerns about, and those are governed by what we call the adjudicative guidelines, which you've already mentioned some of that. It's like foreign contacts, foreign preference, financial actual history, right, too, because, I mean, gambling debts and things like that are concerns to the U.S. government. There is a section on misuse of IT even. So there's a whole bunch of stuff, right? All of that, you know, is part of the SF-86 application, the background investigation. You'll answer questions. And then the reviewers are going to sort of, you know, weigh your suitability against these categories. So I mentioned, because you could sort of get a statement of reasons, a SOR, S-O-R. The government has said, you know, we're not comfortable giving you a clearance right now because of these following areas. Well, at least in the Department of Defense route, you have the right to appeal that. And you have the right for counsel to be present at these hearings. You go to Doha. And if you can sort of convince the government, the administrative law judge there, that whatever adjudicative guideline the reviewers were concerned about, the concerns can be mitigated, and you can still get a clearance. So I want to put that in there as to talk about people going through the process. It's not sort of a just you get a denial letter and, you know, you're maybe can't be employed by whoever hired you to get the needed the work. There is an opportunity for an appeal. You can mitigate some of these things. We could have a whole session maybe on that sometime, maybe even with our labor and employment colleagues, because that's a whole area. So say you get through that whole process, right? Then there's a non-disclosure agreement, the Form 312. It's the Classified Information Non-Disclosure Agreement, which is actually, I think, the current iteration. There's older numbers if you go back, you know, decades or so. But the idea is the same, that you sign an NDA with the U.S. government broadly. And what's interesting is, you know, for those who've signed it, they know this, but for our listeners, right, it's for life. If you leave government employment, or even you're a contractor and you've done this, and you no longer need access to classified information, your clearance will be sort of administratively terminated, but if you need access within, say, 2 years, maybe it can be sort of reinstated, but because the government's already done the background check and the rest. But if you just left the classified world and no intention of ever working the space again, your clearance is, you know, way off in the rearview mirror. You're never going to use it again. You're still bound by the lifetime NDA you signed with the U.S. government. So any information you have in your head that you saw when you were cleared still can't be divulged. So that's kind of not really a myth, but it's sort of another one of the, like, you know, key facts and things that I want to lay out as a baseline, that you sign that form, you're bound for life not to divulge the things. So then, to the point you were saying about getting access to compartments, we should talk about that a little. So everyone who gets a clearance, government or contractor, still has to have a need to know to see a given type of classified information. I think that's highly relevant to the leaks we're hearing in the news, is someone has top secret clearance, they really aren't supposed to be able to go like down the hall to another program, whether this is a government facility or a defense contractor, and go, hey, what are you working on, right? Can I see information? Well, you need to have a need to know that other information. And you mentioned compartments. That made me think of SCI, sensitive compartment information, which is intelligence community thing. Can you tell our listeners what SCI is?
Just generally, yeah. I mean, I think the idea is, I'll use like a Willy Wonka analogy here, that, you know, you don't necessarily want the people who are working on the everlasting gobstoppers don't need to go and have the whatever, the gum or whatever that Violet Beauregard turned her into a giant blueberry. And so, you know, these rooms and sort of the, everything, you know, needs to be sort of walled off from each other, unless, as you said, there's a need to know. So there are various compartments that are set up that handle classified information, usually within the intelligence field, because the compartments are reflect less the information itself than the way in which it was derived and the damage that would occur to U.S. national security if the sort of method of collection, that stream, were exposed. You know, obviously, we also don't want adversaries to know what we know. And, you know, that in and of itself may be a reason to classify something. But the compartments usually have to do with the method. And so there are ones that deal with overhead architecture. There are others that deal with human intelligence, others that deal with signals intelligence, sort of broadly speaking. And then there are, you know, within the DoD realm, there are things that are somewhat analogous called special access programs or SAPs. Sometimes those will deal with sort of intelligence programs that the Defense Department runs. Other times that will be more sort of operationally focused.
So I love the Willy Wonka analogy. That was great. That's actually, Greg, exactly what I was thinking when you walk from room to room, right? Like there's a project in a given room. Wait, you're not clear to access this room. That's why we compartmentalize these things. And SAP, yeah, on the DoD side, I think all of these are under sort of the classified information program, controlled access programs, or CAPs, CAPs. So you got SCI as a type, SAPs another. There are others that we won't get into right now, but there's another myth to dispel that I get often is, you know, someone might say, I have, or I'm applying for a security clearance at a level above top secret. There's no such thing. I've said this for many, many years. There's no level above top secret. There are additional access authorizations that sort of, you will have to go through additional vetting. So it is certainly hugely important if you've got a top secret PCL, personal clearance, and then you're going to get SCI access, or for DoD, like SAP program access. And just to use SAP as an example, because I'm in the defense space a lot, someone could have a TS clearance. They could actually have a TS SCI clearance, and that's still no guarantee that a given DoD program SAP authority is going to give you SAP access. That's still kind of another myth, maybe. It's sort of people thinking, I've got TSSCI, or I've just got TS, I can get into these, you know, compartments or controlled access programs. But no, it's a whole nother level of vetting, but it's not a different classification level.
Well, and it's not only the level of vetting, it's actually, they will then go and limit the access, sometimes numerically.
Oh, the amount of people in the program, right?
We used to run into this often when I was on the Intelligence Committee staff, where there would be a particular program that we would only get, you know, 2 to 3 billets for across the entire staff, majority and minority.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. We've got sort of, there's a constant reevaluating of the people in the billet. So, you know, I'm just pointing out that whether it's a government or contracting security officer, you constantly have to reevaluate the number of people that are read into a given program. And if you really do not have a need for continued access, it's cleaner to just take you out of that. And again, kind of relevant to what's in the news, it was, and this, we're recording this on Friday, may other developments may come to light, but I question maybe why, you know, a 21-year-old National Guardsman here would have all these, you know, trigger all these things, the need to know, the additional compartmented act, you know, to get access to some of the stuff. These are the sort of things, there are supposed to be other steps in the way to go, I mean, do you really need access to this to do your job? But again, I think more is going to come out in the media about what he was actually doing.
So I think, you know, it is highly likely that at some point, given the functions of his job, that he would probably have needed, just by nature of the technical, you know, aspects of it, to come into contact with SCI information. That may have been the reason why Teixeira was apparently in 2021 granted access to SCI. That does not explain necessarily the treasure trove of stuff that he apparently leaked. From what, you know, the little bit that has appeared, the few pages that appeared with the maps, those seem to be mostly the top secret level. I don't know whether any SCI information actually was leaked or not, but be that as it may, it is quite astounding to find that somebody that junior had access to that realm sort of information. It was really quite amazing. There's a lot of people scratching their heads around the Beltway this week.
Yep. And I think another reason we're talking about this now as well is, at any time there is a highly publicized leak, it necessarily requires sort of not only the investigation to determine the leaker, which we've already had, but there may be sort of some blowback within the national security programs here. I'm not talking about a relationship with allies. That's another discussion, right? But I mean, you know, contractors, you're going to be expected to beef up your programs. You know, keep in mind, Edward Snowden was a contractor, and that triggered, and this is another thing for our listeners, that triggered insider threat reporting requirements and plans and procedures that cleared contractors had not formally had to do before. So create a whole new layer, right? And also within the government too. So anytime we got one of these situations, it's not only the current investigating the current issue, but also, you know, there may be different rules and procedures. Things need to be tightened up. Like, one thing that we've talked about, to kind of veer a little in sort of the cybersecurity realm a little bit, is both at the classified level and also, and I'll touch on this a little bit more, that what we used to call the sensitive but unclassified, or SBU, which is now called controlled unclassified information, or CUI level. There's all sorts of cybersecurity requirements the government has, and also for industry as well. But this particular leak shows up another weakness we've seen in both the CUI world and the classified world about. There's your cybersecurity protections, but that's just part of your broader security. In this leak context, I understand the kid here, the individual, you know, took hard copies of documents, right? Put them in his pocket, left some facility with them, and then took pictures of them. So you've kind of left the boundaries of an information system that you printed them off of. This is a constant sort of security question, both in industry and the government, about, well, cybersecurity is responsibility of our cybersecurity guys. And then we have physical security, you know, the building, the doors, the badges, the man traps to get in and out of the room, the vault, or SCIF, secure compartment information facility. But what about bag checks? What about people who are carrying things out? You know, this is sort of, I defer to you on the maybe more the intelligence community history on this, but this is like old fashioned Cold War spycraft stuff, where you go, I have a hard copy of a document in a bag. Wasn't that how I think Hansen was handling stuff to his handlers? Literal hard copy documents in a bag dropped off somewhere. This is old fashioned stuff. It's not electronic classified information that got out. It's a hard copy.
He was doing that. And then Aldrich Ames, I think, was also sort of leaving CIA headquarters with, you know, bulging briefcases on a Friday afternoon. You know, interestingly, Chelsea Manning, I think that was a CD, right? Like a Taylor Swift CD.
Yeah.
That she copied her stuff on.
Yeah, recorded over it.
Snowden was used a thumb drive.
Yep.
And so we've sort of gone now back to the future, if you will. Although, to anybody who's contemplating doing this, most classified printers will log, you know, who printed and what they printed. And also there are these invisible little dots that will rat you out. So don't do this. But, you know, on a serious note, so look, after, you know, some of the other IC breaches, you know, while I was on the intelligence committee staff, there were always calls for more sort of stringent searches, you know, checking people's bags on the way out. There's a couple of agencies that have experimented with random bag checks. I will say that for all the potential deterrence factor that that might have in a situation like this, the sort of effect on the workforce is sort of something to consider equally, if not more strongly. Most people working in the intelligence community have given up a lot to earn those positions of trust. And you know, they sort of don't want to have a sort of daily reminder, if you will, that maybe they aren't fully trusted. We're going to have to find some kind of happy medium. You know, one thing we haven't talked about here, and maybe we'll have to do this on another podcast, is sort of the move from these periodic reevaluations and of people sort of every 5 years to more of this continuous evaluation where the security folks are gathering up some basic data on people on an ongoing basis just to see if there's anything financial or otherwise that would trip their sensors, so to speak. But in this case, you know, this was sort of a real outlier, right? It wasn't for any of the traditional reasons. Frankly, more than anything else, it was a maturity issue, I think. You know, I don't know how you screen for that, either in the initial process or on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, I agree with that. The move is to continuous monitoring and continuous evaluation of cleared individuals and their activities rather than sort of the periodic reinvestigation, which in theory sounds better because it's a pain to have to sort of redo a whole investigation every certain amount of years or whatever. But this does raise a whole host of questions I think we might want to talk about in a future episode about the monitoring of data on cleared individuals. So you mentioned insider threat earlier, and you just made a great point about the effect on the workforce, right? After Edward Snowden, insider threat became like the buzzword, you know, both within the government and for industry. But whether you're in government or you're in industry, if you now know that your activities are being monitored outside of the workplace for any activity indicative of an insider threat, that raises a whole host of other issues. And I think this stuff is out there where you can see briefings and presentations and best practices or the security community about, hey, here's individual so-and-so. And look, they went to Vegas and they posted stuff on Facebook, and your security officer could be reading all these things. Now, that's, again, why this might be a different discussion in the future, because certainly folks are generally aware, you know, your employer may be monitoring activity while you're in the workplace. You signed up to stuff like that. But this is the security realm, right? Like, you may not necessarily know what's being monitored, but that is kind of what the reaction was after Edward Snowden. And to sort of wrap that up, you made a great point on this latest leak. There's not really, at this point, you know, it's not really clear that any of the sort of traditional things you would look for under those adjudicative guidelines you mentioned, right? Foreign activity, foreign preference, other the things that are insider threat programs are supposed to usually be looking for, it's not clear that would have really all come up. You know, there's definitely activity on like an online server. We see that on this Discord server, but this may not really be within the realm of anyone's insider threat program to catch.
It's going to be interesting in the coming days and weeks to see whether his colleagues in the Air Force or any of the other military folks he came into contact with down at Bragg, whether they had any concerns about him. Because obviously, if there was concern and it wasn't acted on, that's an entirely different breakdown, if you will, of the system.
Yeah, I think that's another point we can kind of sort of at the end here leave with our listeners too, is that's another area in this whole realm that you generally are expected, if you have reasonable information about someone who's cleared, to report to that security officer. But that's a whole other host of issues there, right? I think the language and the guidance is can't make reports based on suspicion or innuendo. Well, how do you go from that to like, I actually have something I know about my colleague that the security officer needs to know? So,
right.
So I think we've covered a lot today, actually. I think we need to do a couple more on some specific areas, again, in the classified world and sort of one area that we've talked about in the past. And the context, I mean, our previous episode about cooperating with allies and the AUKUS treaty. that I'd like to revisit is classified information sharing with allies, because there's foreign government information, or FGI, that the U.S. government gets, and we also give information to our allies, but there's certain rules about how that plays out. And it's also, just since we just talked about AUKUS and the subs, submarines, I think that maybe that's a topic for another episode, is sort of international allied sharing of classified information across the globe.
You know, and that just reminded me, there's one last thing I want to float and just see if you have any thoughts about it as well before we go. You know, there's an ongoing move in Congress, you know, for security clearance reform, which, you know, if you read between the lines, means speeding it up. What do you think this latest episode, you know, it sort of had seemed that there had been some movement in this Congress and that maybe something finally was going to really get done. And I'm getting the sense now that this is exactly the kind of episode that slows down those efforts until everybody gets a handle on what's going on.
Yeah, I think I agree with you that that's unfortunate. It will probably slow down those efforts, which is, again, unfortunate, I think, sort of for getting the security clearance process to speed up a little. I will give credit to our, you know, the U.S. government agencies in the last few years. Processing times have gotten better. There's clear data out there about processing folks for secret and top secret. So they were just getting faster, right? They were just starting to get faster, I think, in the last year. And now I think this is going to have a bit of a damper on security clearance reform. And another related piece for security clearance reform is, I think this was in the last NDAA, is pilot program to fast track clearances for folks who are working, you know, for emerging tech companies. That's a huge challenge, I think, for national security innovation, and that the cool emerging technology that the national security infrastructure of the U.S. wants to, you know, buy or fund for R&D, engineers and students and all these folks need to get clearances to do certain things, but it takes a long time to get them cleared. So you're kind of stuck here with how can you fund the best and most interesting technology that's vital for national security if it takes so long to clear a PhD or a student that's vital for this, right? And that's all part of the reform effort too. So I am concerned that I think, unfortunately, it's going to slow down again now after this latest leak.
All right. With that, Mike, you really are, you know your stuff on this security clearance issue.
And I like we spell out the acronyms. That is an important key, because we all speak the acronym speak here in the DC and Beltway area, but we'll try to make sure that we always are clear on what we're talking about. Like I said, DCSA, Security Clearance Regulator, DSCA, Security Cooperation Agency. Happens all the time in the government.
All righty. I will see you either next Friday or in two Fridays or sometime soon. In the meantime, have a great weekend.
Have a great weekend. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. To learn more about top 10 global law firm Hogan Lovells, with more than 50 offices worldwide, please visit HoganLovells.com.